Okay, welcome back to Unplugged Podcast here on OncLive and MedNewsWeek. Very happy to have one of the leaders in breast cancer, Dr. Stephanie Graf. She's the director of breast oncology at Lifespan Cancer Institute. So thank you for joining us. And I know one of the things that's really kind of taken off is metastatic hormone receptor positive breast cancer. And one of the things that really helps out the primary care with the primary oncologist, the general oncologist, is that sequencing with the CDK4/6, the question of palbociclib with the Paloma study, with the phase 3, you didn't get that overall survival. But then you have the ribociclib with AI, maybe with fulvestrant. But then you have this post-MONARCH study, maybe the continuation. And so what are your expert thoughts on the post-MONARCH study?
Yeah, I think the post-MONARCH study is really important. We'd previously seen the results of the MAINTAIN study, which sort of was dipping our toe into the water, and this continuing CDK4/6 after CDK4/6 inhibitor. That data was positive, but really wasn't designed as, you know, a registrational study or a study that would change practice. So the post-MONARCH was this big phase 3 randomized trial that randomized patients after progression on a CDK4/6 inhibitor to either fulvestrant alone or fulvestrant plus abemaciclib. What we saw was that continuing a CDK4/6 inhibitor, in this case, abemaciclib, regardless of what first-line CDK4/6 inhibitor you received, did result in a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival. And for me, in the trenches daily with patients, the longer I can keep patients on oral therapy that targets estrogen, that's relatively easy to take, that doesn't require a lot of thought about the patient matches the criteria, is a win, right? About 30% of the patients on post-MONARCH had previously had ribociclib. So, you know, you can probably reasonably assume that it works in that situation too, although the vast majority of the patients had had prior palbociclib. And we really thought that that benefit existed regardless of their mutational profile. So patients with PIK3CA, patients with ESR1 still benefited from abema plus fulvestrant. Interestingly, the fulvestrant alone arm did much better in post-MONARCH than we've seen in any of these second line therapies, almost 3 months better than in Capitello 291 or Emerald. And so I don't know what that means, if we're getting smarter about who to put on second line endocrine therapy, or if there's just something different. But I think the fact that even with that sort of super performance of the control arm, that we still saw abemaciclib result in this improved progression-free survival is notable. But I don't think this is where we're going to end up long-term. I think that we'll see CDK4/6 inhibitors in the second line get combined with other things, potentially PIK3CA drugs. I'm sure you're going to ask me about an IBO 120, and definitely with SERDs, right? Because I don't think that medicines like elacestrant, imlunestrant, et cetera, are going to really end up as single agents. I think we're going to be using them in combination with all these other drugs. And we know EMBER-3 has already accrued, and we're waiting for those results, hopefully within the next year, to look at abemaciclib plus imlunestrant.
Yeah, you know, maybe a backbone, like you mentioned, because you know a lot about the future studies that are coming out, and just kind of a proof in principle to continue with the CDK4/6. But maybe with a different dance partner. And then there are some people that kind of believe that abemaciclib, a little bit different than ribociclib in terms of the biology of it, maybe a little bit stronger CDK4 maybe. So there's actually like a biological rationale behind that as well, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that we certainly see that the CDK4/6 inhibitors have slightly different efficacies as we start to look in their longer term overall survival data. And we also see very different side effect profiles across the three drugs. And all of those are just warning signs to us that they're probably selecting their targets just slightly differently. And so I think it rationally makes sense that we're seeing a little bit of a benefit for abema after the other CDK4/6 inhibitors.
Absolutely. And then in the first line space, it was a very selected patient population, but it wasn't a first line study with the INOVO 120. Where the patients, I guess it was a 12-month progression where they had that first-line metastatic ER-positive breast cancer. What was your thoughts on that phase 3 study and the design of it? It's not the typical patient population you see.
Yeah, INOVO 120 is the trial I love to hate. INOVO 120, like you said, is a very specific patient population. So it took patients that had what I'm going to call rapid progression endocrine therapy. So these are patients with hormone receptor positive breast cancer that either relapsed on their adjuvant endocrine therapy or within a year of completing their adjuvant endocrine therapy. And often, you know, that's not what we see in clinic, right? Patients have been off endocrine therapy for 3 years, for 5 years, for 20 years, and then they're coming back into our clinic with their metastatic disease presentation. And so that's not the INAVO 120 population. These are patients that are recurring very quickly. All of the patients had PIK3CA mutations, which we also know is a high-risk phenotype. So we're also seeing a biologically selected high-risk population. And then patients were randomized to either get palbociclib plus fulvestrant as a control arm, or palbociclib plus fulvestrant plus inbalusimab, INAVO, which is a PIK3CA inhibitor. And what we saw was that obviously it met its primary endpoint in improved progression-free survival from 7.3 months to 15 months, which is huge. Huge win, very, very positive study. The problem is that in a PIK3CA selected patient population, the control arm did not get PIK3CA targeted therapy. So I don't know what that really means. If patients in the control arm went on to get alpelisib or capivasertib, the approved PIK3CA targeted therapy, would we see a difference? How would the sequencing affect things? We know that uptake in the community, the broader breast community, whether that's community practice or academia, of PIK3CA drugs hasn't been stellar because they're hard to give. And that was really the crux of the ASCO 2024 presentation, was a lot of the updates on the side effects and the toxicity. I thought it was interesting the presenter actually went through and talked about the concomitant medications. And over 80% of patients on this study ended up taking loperamide and metformin for diarrhea or hyperglycemia, respectively. And a very high proportion also were on topical hydrocortisone for rashes or steroid mouthwash for stomatitis. And wow. I think that anytime we have a three-drug therapy that results in a four-drug supportive care regimen, we're really getting into complex medical care. Now, I do think that's the bread and butter of oncology. Most of us are just excellent side effect managers. It's part of what we do. But I think that trying to figure out how this really fits into the landscape with that control arm in this first line setting is complicated.
Absolutely. And you know, our patients that are metastatic, ER positive, once you're stage four, we have to consider tolerability for our patients because of the quality of life. And so I thought you brought some outstanding points. I mean, even if you think about like the sugar abnormalities with the PIK3CA, the community oncologist might not have an endocrinologist right next to them, right? So you start ending up prescribing metformin, maybe insulin, and next thing you know, just so many things are going on with the patient.
Yeah, I actually feel like maybe our community oncologists have endocrinologists more readily than some of our academic colleagues. Tell your kids, go into endocrinology.
That's right.
We certainly need them. And, you know, again, it's because INAVO 120 anticipated that that was going to be a side effect on this combo. Another sort of restriction, when we think about the patients that were selected, there were pretty tight eligibility criteria around things like your baseline hemoglobin A1C and your baseline fasting blood sugar. And so this was also a very metabolically healthy group of patients that were on the study. And yet we still saw rates of hyperglycemia.
Kind of a very handpicked group, like the most fit, the less chance of having that hyperglycemia with sugar levels in the 400-500. So very self-selected groups. Moving on to, in terms of DESTINY-Breast06, this right here, things are kind of moving along here. We had, you know, TDXD slowly moving up. And so the question I have for you, Stephanie, is a lot of our community oncologists have this question about endocrine sensitivity and endocrine resistance, because this is in the first line chemo space. So any advice or any guidance on that?
My first thought is that this is first line chemo, which does not mean that we should not be giving first line, second line, even third line endocrine therapy. The vast majority of the patients on DESTINY-Breast06 had had multiple prior lines of endocrine therapy. So I don't want anyone to think that this sequence is now first line aromatase inhibitor plus CDK4/6 inhibitor, second line TDXD for everyone, because that is not the takeaway of DESTINY-Breast06. I think, you know, we've seen, again, PIK3CA targeting, ESR1 targeting, the post-monarch results. There's so many opportunities between first-line endocrine therapy and moving into that chemotherapy setting. The second question is, should everyone even get DESTINY-Breast06? And I think that question really remains unanswered as a result of the data we have thus far presented at ASCO. What I mean to say is that, of course, in DESTINY-Breast04, which at this point I think we all know very well, second-line chemotherapy with HER2-low metastatic breast cancer, the vast majority of the trial participants had hormone receptor-positive breast cancer. And in DESTINY-Breast04, what we saw was that it improved median progression-free survival by 4.7 months. And the objective response rate was 52%. So patients got a very significant reduction in the size of their tumor burden with second-line TDXD. And patients stayed on their duration of response in DESTINY-Breast04 with trastuzumab deruxtecan was 10.7 months. So grand slam for DESTINY-Breast04. So now we look at DESTINY-Breast06, which is taking that same drug, trastuzumab deruxtecan, and just giving it one line earlier as the first chemo that you might choose. Where so often we're choosing something like capecitabine or single agent paclitaxel, which I think we can all agree are very well tolerated first line chemotherapies. And in DESTINY-Breast06, the improvement in progression-free survival was 5.1 months, which is really close to what we saw in DESTINY-Breast04 in the second line. So if we get about the same benefit, regardless of whether we give it first or second, it's not clear if everyone needs it first. And so to me, this gives us more tricks in our bag that we can look to, more dialogue and discussion with patients. But I don't necessarily think that all patients are going to need trastuzumab deruxtecan in that first line setting. I think that there'll be some dialogue and consideration about side effects and how that, you know, the difference between something like oral capecitabine versus infusional TDXD might look for a patient experience.
Yeah, outstanding points. I just love everything you were saying about that, because if we take it from the patient's journey, right, we have first line CDK4/6, AI, then it's kind of like biomarker driven, you know, you look for P10, AKT, check for germline, BRCA2, BRCA1. We still want to kind of give that if they have a BRCA2, BRCA1.
And then PALB2 in there too.
Right, PALB2, right? And then PIK3CA, PIK. And so then you start thinking, okay, from the breast cancer patients, that IV chemo is like that, kind of like that next step that you kind of jump over. So you still have that capecitabine a little bit to kind of maybe slow that process before you get to that IV chemo. Because so much of it is like a psychological and emotional kind of a thing too. And so, like you said, that it gives us more options. But this is why, like you and I, we kind of love oncology, because when we think about cancer patients, we think about what's best for each individual person, you know? And is this something that you kind of notice as well, Stephanie? Like, every person's different, right?
And what matters to them is different, right? Like, some patients, the idea of a drug that causes diarrhea is a deal breaker, right? They had a prior chemotherapy and they had horrible diarrhea and they just say never again. And alternatively, for some patients, the idea of a drug that carries a, you know, 50% risk of hair loss is a gamble they want to delay as long as they possibly can. And so, you know, sometimes you just have to get down into the trenches and talk about what really matters with each patient and figure out logically what steps in that treatment plan make the most sense.
Absolutely. Now, switching gears, I know we kind of talked about, you know, the TDXD and Destiny Breast 06, a very interesting study. And I want to kind of see what your thoughts on this is. You know, the SASE-IO study, it seems like the combination, can it kind of create this synergy where it kind of helps out patient care? What are your thoughts about the SASE-IO study?
Yeah, I mean, so SASE-IO was a phase two trial that randomized patients with metastatic, again, hormone receptor positive breast cancer to either sacituzumab govitecan or sacituzumab govitecan with pembrolizumab. I think one of the key takeaways is immunotherapy is coming for you, friends, no matter what field you're in. So, you know, obviously we've got an approval for immune checkpoint inhibitors and triple negative breast cancer and across the keynote body of trials and some combination trials with everything from sacituzumab, Dato-DXd, trastuzumab, deruxtecan. We're starting to see combinations with immune checkpoint inhibitors. Here's an example, right? So this trial was a phase two, relatively small sample size, 110 patients. So definitely not practice changing. And ultimately, it was a negative trial. It did not meet statistical significance for its endpoint. But what we did see was that the patients who had PD-L1 positive, hormone receptor positive breast cancer that got sacituzumab plus pembrolizumab appeared to have the greatest benefit in progression-free survival. For those patients, it improved progression-free survival from 11 months to 18 months. Interestingly, that 7-month difference did not meet statistical significance, which I think is amazing. It really speaks to the small sample size. But there's ongoing trials in this space. ASCENT-04 is adding pembrolizumab to sacituzumab govitecan for triple negative breast cancer. There's a whole body of trials looking at adding various different chemotherapies to pembrolizumab for hormone receptor positive disease. And I think another big question, which so many other researchers are working on, like Dr. Shireen Loy, for example, are really trying to answer that question, is PD-L1 even the thing? Because I don't know that that is the thing, especially in hormone receptor positive breast cancer. It might be TILs or some other marker of immune infiltration. We saw in the data from the I-SPY trial that the mammoprint immune signature may play a role in selecting patients. I think that we still need to try to figure out which hormone receptor positive patients are the right patients to marry to immune checkpoint inhibitors.
Yeah, I think those are outstanding points. And, you know, one of the things that I was kind of thinking about, because I treat bladder cancer patients and this combination of ADC with immunotherapy, there's some question about at the basic science level that the antibody drug conjugates may make the immunotherapy a little bit stronger. And so this study was kind of negative, but I know you have some other studies that have showed that synergy with the ADC and the IO.
So, yeah, I mean, and I think we thought DESTINY-Breast07 was also reported at ASCO, which was using trastuzumab deruxtecan in a variety of different backdrops in HER2-positive breast cancer. At ASCO 2024, we saw trastuzumab deruxtecan monotherapy and trastuzumab deruxtecan plus pertuzumab presented by Dr. Fabrice André. They do have some modules in that trial looking at trastuzumab deruxtecan plus immune checkpoint inhibitors. So we're waiting to see the outcomes of those. We've already seen preliminary data from Begonia looking at datopotumumab deruxtecan, which we'll now just call Dato-DXd, to save me the tongue twister, in combination with durvalumab, which looked very promising. Again, that's what we saw Dr. Schapsky from the I-SPY family present. Again, very promising signal. It will graduate from the I-SPY 2.2 to become, hopefully a phase three trial trying to look at that question. And then TROPION-05 and TROPION-03 are both looking at combining based on PD-L1 positivity. Again, is that really the thing? Dato-DXd plus durvalumab. So lots of immune checkpoint inhibitors plus ADC is happening. I think that's one of the big headlines that we can all expect probably at ASCO 2026. because it'd take a while for those trials to mature.
Yeah, that's what I love about you. Like, you're always looking ahead. Like, you're looking at the studies, and you and I kind of talked before. It's like, you had this study, and everybody's analyzing the study, but, like, you're, like, looking ahead and said, okay, what does this mean here for patient care? What does this mean for, like, clinical designs? I think it's great that you kind of mentioned, like, the ASCO 2026, and you're, because, like, you're always looking ahead. So, any lasting thoughts about any kind of studies that caught your eye or anything like that, Stephanie?
I think another big theme that came out of ASCO 2024 was ctDNA. We saw data both from the Mona Lisa trial looking at ribociclib, as well as data from the Monarch E trial looking at ctDNA. And across those studies, what we saw was that ctDNA can be very prognostic of the outcome that we expect in a patient living with cancer or after a cancer diagnosis. But what I want everyone to know is that those tools still, I don't think, are ready for prime time. There's a lot of variability in the sensitivity of the ctDNA tools that are available commercially and in research. And we still don't yet know what interventions would change, whether it would just create lead time bias or actually change outcomes when we find that. And so I encourage, you know, if that's something that you're considering, I encourage you to look for either local trials or regional trials for your patients that are interested in pursuing ctDNA testing, because right now, I don't know that it's something that it's ready to implement in our daily clinical practices.
Thank you so much, Stephanie. I always enjoy our conversations, learning from you, and you had some outstanding points.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk.